this is Amy Hall, and you're listening to Stand to Reason's hashtag SDR Ask podcast with Greg Kokel.
Morning.
And Greg's here,
Amy.
Okay, Greg, here is a question from Mike. Even though the Old Testament wasn't intended to be permanent, and aside from atheists ultimately having no moral ground to critique it, how can you best explain the internal inconsistency of its harshness compared to the New Testament? That's his first question. Second question, also, if God is sovereign, why not set up a system that doesn't require a harsh Old Testament and a system of redemption in the first place?
Well, both questions are making a presumption. And the presumption is the Old Testament God is harsh and the New Testament God isn't. I just think this is inaccurate. And incidentally, this particular question has been mulled over by lots of people. So when I'm speaking here, I'm not speaking just kind of off the top of my head. The fact is the Old Testament is absolutely chock full of examples of God's long-suffering grace. Look at 400 years from Abraham until the conquest of the land where the Canaanites are punished, all right? 400 years of patience, all right? How many kings in the northern kingdom? 20. How many in the southern kingdom? 20 after the split, all right? And how many kings were good in the northern kingdom? None. Hundreds of years, 20 dynasties before God finally lowered the boom on them. Now, there were some kings that were good in the southern kingdom, so there was a longer period of time in Judah before 486 and Nebuchadnezzar and the destruction of the temple, etc. God is consistently long-suffering in Scripture. And this is David. He champions the virtues of God in this regard all the time in the Psalms. The word chesed, C-H-E-S-E-D, the anglicized version of this Hebrew word, means God's covenant faithfulness. And notice, by the way, even in the Ten Commandments where he says that I will visit the sin of the one generation to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but to the thousandth generation of those who love me. So he's not counting generations. He's making an example. He said, yes, you as a nation, you know, if you go south, it's going to be bad for you. But my mercy is so much bigger than my anger and my wrath and my judgment. And it's evidenced in this kind of metaphoric comparison here, even in the Decalogue, all right, the Ten Commandments. So it is false to say that God is a harsh God in the Old Testament compared to the New Testament, all right? All the mercies of God are manifest, and the patience of God. I mean, please, I just read through Numbers and Joshua, right? Okay, I'm pausing. I'm doing some New Testament stuff right now, but I have lazy exclamation marks in my margin of my Bible because I'm thinking, you idiots. You idiots, look at what God has done to all the people that screwed up and all the people that opposed you and how God has blessed you when you obey him. And now you're going the other way again. You idiots, how could you do that? But see, God is still faithful. Now, there's judgment that comes, but I mean, God is still faithful to Israel, all right? And when they broke the new covenant, what did he do? Enough of you guys? I'm sorry, when they broke the old covenant, what did he do? Okay, I'm done with you guys. All right. There is a little bit of language like that where God's, in a sense, expressing frustration. And I think that's kind of an anthropomorphism again, because the fact is he comes back and he is faithful to Israel. He's not going to abandon them. Okay, you broke the old covenant. I'm going to give you a new one you can't break. Jeremiah 31:31 and following. Okay. And then he goes on and talks about the new covenant. So there is God's mercy and long-suffering and chesed, covenant faithfulness, all over the Old Testament. Now, the New Testament, Jesus meek and mild. It's interesting. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son so that whoever believes in him would not perish but have everlasting life. Oh, that's nice. That's the loving God, right? And you keep reading. That's John 3:16. John 3:36. He who believes in the Son has life. He who does not believe, the wrath of God abides on him. Okay? And, boy, there might be a little bit different emphasis in the New Testament, at least in the life of Jesus. But the warnings are replete. And, in fact, you look at Acts chapter 10, and there's Cornelius, and then if you believe in the message, you believe in him, there's going to be forgiveness of sins. Implication, if you don't believe, there's no forgiveness. Then you got, Acts 18, and Paul's on Mars Hill, and he said, God, here's the God you're worshiping. Let me tell you about them. You worship in ignorance. I'll tell you the truth about him. Look at what he's done. He's done all these nice things to make it easy to understand and to see him, but he set a man that he's going to judge the world. All right? He's sending a man. His name is Jesus, having provided proof by raising him from the dead. Wow, there's judgment there. All right. And then, of course, in the book of Revelation, we get a picture of that, and that is not a pretty picture at all. Now it all comes down. So I don't accept the character, the claim that the biblical characterization of God is a different one in the Old Testament than in the New Testament. In both cases, you find vibrant and rich and substantive examples of wrath and anger, harshness, if you will, and also of mercy and forgiveness.
Mm-hmm. Also, I think just regarding the second part of his question here, if God is sovereign, why not set up a system that doesn't require a harsh Old Testament and a system of redemption in the first place? One of the first things you have to note here is that this is one story. This is not two separate stories. This is one story. And I think it's because of God's sovereignty that he worked it out this way, because God had a particular goal in mind, and his goal was to reveal his grace. And in order to reveal his grace, he first has to reveal his righteousness and his justice. And just this morning, I was reading in Romans, and I came across in chapter 5 when Paul is talking about how we all died in Adam. And he's talking about how through Adam's one sin, we were all came under judgment. And he says, the law came in so that the transgression would increase. In other words, the law reveals our sin, because he also says in chapter 7, I would not have come to know sin except through the law. So when the law shows us our sin, it reveals who we are. Already, it's only bringing out our own sin and helping us realize how far we are from God's righteousness. So the law was really important in doing that. The law was here to lead us to Christ. The law was here, and note that in Galatians, Paul makes a big deal, and this goes back to the first part of Mike's question here. Paul talks about how Abraham was saved by faith. That was by grace. It was his faith was credited to him as righteousness. And so because of that, the law coming in didn't negate that covenant of faith that he had with God. The law had another purpose, and that purpose was to reveal our sin and the need for God's grace. So that's why the law came in. But the whole thing was based on grace in the covenant with Abraham, where he had faith and God mm-hmm. granted that promise to him by faith. So there was this grace all the way through here, but the law, the purpose of the law was to show us the righteousness of God. It was to create a society that would better reflect God to the world, that would bring about the Messiah. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, the goal was for God to reveal his grace on the cross, and we can only understand that if we understand our own sinfulness. And it's also a good reminder to remember that God still has...
Good reminder to remember.
Good reminder. God still has the exact same requirement of perfect righteousness. That has not changed.
Uh-huh.
The only thing is, in the New Testament, it's revealed that Christ will fulfill that requirement for us. So you get an understanding, a full revelation. Again, one story. First has revealed our sinfulness. In light, but still in wrapped up in God's grace. But ultimately, it's revealed that by grace that we'll have the righteousness of Christ, not by law. The The law is there to reveal our sin. So there's a lot going on here, but the New Testament has so much to say about the law, especially in Hebrews, in Galatians, and in Romans. So that would be a good place to start if you want to read about what the Bible has to say about the law and the New Testament and how those two things work together. Mm-hmm. So, Greg, here's another question about the law, and this one comes from Michael. Wouldn't the fact that the command to not eat blood was given both to Noah in Genesis 9:4 and to New Testament believers, Acts 15:29, make it transcend the Mosaic covenant and therefore be binding on us today?
Well, it's a fair question. But if you notice in Acts 15, and ironically, I just read this the other day. I was reading that passage for a different reason. As I recall, this is a prudential directive that is given so as not to offend Jews. It is not being identified in Acts 15 as a transcendent moral good, but it is being identified as a sensitivity to Jews who respect the law, not to offend them. And I think that's what it says. For we have people, you know, who Jews in every community where you're we're going here in Galatian region, etc. And so this is why they have it. And anyway, who drink? I mean, I don't know who drinks blood nowadays anyway. I mean, we don't eat the blood. I mean, generally speaking, as a practical matter, I guess there are some sausages, a blood sausage, or the Maasai drink blood, you know. But that isn't a part of our – it isn't a practical concern for us anyway. But I don't think it is, even though this was a directive given to Noah, and I'd have to look more closely at that. I don't see that as being it's only repeated in the New Testament in the context of being sensitive to Jews who have this requirement within their law.
I'm torn on this one, Greg, just because the other things mentioned in chapter 15 are moral considerations. So I'm looking for them now. They abstain from things contaminated by idols and from fornication and from what is strangled and from blood. And so obviously fornication and idols are moral concerns. I think I would also need to know, and this is something I don't think is entirely clear, why this was said to Noah and why this was said, why God was against mm-hmm. eating the blood in the Old Testament. And it could very well have had to do with idolatry and religious things and trying to have power, trying to get power from other creatures. I really don't know the answer to that. And so it's hard for me to assess what it means in this particular instance, knowing that fornication is also a moral concern. So what do you think about that?
Yeah, but I don't know. What about I don't think strangling is, and the not eating things contaminated by idols. Paul addresses that in Romans, I think, and says that, you know, an idol's not anything. And meat sacrificed to idols is not in itself contaminated, but it does create problems for the conscience of other people. So I see this falling in a similar category as eating things with the blood issue, because there are Jews that are going to be offended. So again, I think that strikes me as more prudential. I'm looking for the passage myself. That strikes me as more of a prudential issue and not strictly a moral issue.
Do you have any thoughts on why the commandment was given to Noah?
No, I don't. I just have an impulse, and that is that God's just setting up this sense of blood sacrifice and atonement, and the same reason that he rationale behind telling the Jews. I don't think there's anything in the blood in itself that becomes that's immoral. And most of these transcendent laws they are they are kind of open to a commonsensical evaluation. We can see, apart from the application of the law, practical application, we see just the nature of it. Thou shalt not murder, steal, you know, obey your parents, all of these things. They seem to have a self-attesting quality to them, the universal things. But it does not, it doesn't, I don't understand that with regards to the blood. And so that invites us to consider some other alternatives, mm-hmm. especially since the blood thing is only raised in the New Testament, as in my view at least, as a prudential concern in light of other people's sensibilities, the Jews in this case.
Yeah, thinking back to the explanation given in the Mosaic Law, I think it says something like, you're not supposed to eat the blood, you're supposed to pour it out because the blood was given to us for sacrifice, something like that, like, mm-hmm. like you mentioned this, Greg. So I would suppose that those kinds of considerations wouldn't really come into play now. I'm not sure. But anyway, I appreciate your thoughts. That's helpful, I think.
Notice there's two parts in Acts 15 where this is discussed. Verse 20, where they're talking about it and they come to the conclusion and they give the reason why they came to the conclusion. And then later on when they actually write the letter and they don't give their rationale, they just give their conclusion. But the rationale is in verse 20. Write to them. And verse 21, write to them that they abstain from things contaminated by idols and from fornication and from what is strangled and from blood. For Moses from ancient generation has in every city those who preach him, since he has read in the synagogues every Sabbath. So there's the rationale. But I don't think that means that fornication is just offensive mm-hmm. to Jews, so don't do it. We know from other passages that fornication is offensive because it's wrong.
And then going back to Genesis, now I'm looking at Genesis 9:4. Here's the rationale given there. He says, only you shall not eat flesh with its life, that is its blood. So there is an emphasis there on somehow this idea that when you're eating the blood, you're illegitimately trying to claim its life, or you're trying something about the life belonging to God. So that does seem to have mm-hmm. kind of religious implications that it wouldn't have now, even if people were eating blood. Although mm-hmm. you were talking about tribes drinking blood, it could very well have something to do with that sort of thing.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know. Maybe this is too much speculation.
But it does make me think that just, no, but think of what you had just said. And then think of Jesus' comments in the upper room, and he said, this is the covenant of my blood. I mean, this is the blood who's shed for you. Drink it. Now, I don't hold that there was something metaphysical going on there, but it's representative. It's representative of the blood of Christ. And so when we believe in him, we are in a certain sense, we are benefiting from the blood shed on our behalf. The life of the blood is now going into us because of Christ's sacrifice on our behalf. So I think that picture is still sustained even in the New Testament. So I think you're onto something there, Amy.
You actually just gave me an idea also. One thing that the Old Testament does is it limits certain things to the temple. Like certain incense, certain mixtures of incense, certain clothing, certain things, because God wanted to reserve that for the religious purpose. So maybe
sacred.
Maybe that has something to do with this also. God did not want that to be a practice where they drink the blood or they eat the blood, because that was reserved for our relationship with Christ and having his life. It's a possibility. There could be a lot of things at play here, but again,
whatever. It is not a reference that resonates with modern people, because we're still trying to figure that out. But it presumably resonated with ancient peoples mm-hmm. who understood the world in a different way, and so this is a framework, a way of. A typology of sorts that is being invested in the minds of those people in light of their own sensibilities, so they get the connection.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Greg, and thank you, Mike, and thank you, Michael. Two different Mikes. We appreciate your questions. Mm-hmm. Those are great questions. And we look forward to hearing from you with your questions. So send that on Twitter with the hashtag STRAsk. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.